lessons told me, yeah, no flexing on me. My attorney gon' call and collect. Blessings on blessings for me. My successes only made them envious. They got upset. I had to put all their egos in check.
Hey.
I want the money, the power, respect. And I heard you know so-and-so, you're not a threat.
Cause what
I
really is know happening?
So they like my family, so they go.
My favorite people. They busted your motherfucking chest. Sorry about the MF in there. I usually fade out by then. Just blame it on poor judgment for me, not you. This is Simon, Closed Network, Privacy Podcast, episode number 32. Recorded today, Sunday, April 7th, 2024. How's everyone doing? It's warming up, sort of. It's been windy out here. Been windy out here in the western U.S. That's right, I'm in the United States. I was actually posting some listening data to the Matrix chat last few days, and it's actually interesting to see that only like 43 or 46% of listeners were even in the United States. These aren't like 100% stats because they're just aggregated based upon downloads, IP addresses of, you know, the downloads through Anchor, that, you know, I just host all the files through there. And so they just aggregate some of the data. I imagine a lot of people are on VPNs or accessing the website directly, but yeah, it was kind of low for what I thought, which actually kind of made me happy that we have so many listeners around the globe. And the chat has been really active lately. The main Closed Network Podcast Matrix chat. And so people are kind of explaining where they are and what region they're in, what challenges they're facing. Obviously there's some more than others. India comes to mind. So we have some listeners and people in the chat from India talking about the struggles and the challenges that they're going through with a lot of the legislation around VPNs. Basically, the way I understand it, I haven't delved into it, is they are pushing to have a know your customer record for VPN users. So you can use a VPN, but the VPN has to be tied to a user's information. I'm assuming there's a minimum amount. I actually was sent the PDF. Somebody posted it to the chat, and I did go through and read some of it. And it was quite dystopian on that particular bill where this kind of came about. So that's not what the show's about. It was just kind of a learning lesson for me. Always learning something new. We're always sharing ideas. Anyone is free to join. We have some other things I'll talk about in a minute that I'm working on, but anyone's free to join. You can just go set up an account with Element. I believe it's just element.io. It's the Matrix client. It's probably the easiest one to use. Once you start using it, there's a ton of other applications that you may want to use instead of Element, but it's just the easiest way to onboard, because once you actually install Element, whether it's on your phone or your computer, then you can just go to closednetwork.io, click join the Matrix chat. There's also an OT chat, what we call off topic, and that's kind of memes and things that aren't necessarily on topic within the privacy security category, if you will. Not that everything has to be, it's just that that's just kind of where everything else goes, all the jokes and funny stuff and that kind of thing. So before I get too far along, I'll give you a quick rundown of the episode. I probably won't get to everything because I always put way too much stuff in my show notes, but I'm going to try. I just keep adding stuff to the show note document, and I look at it going like, there's no way I could get to all this and keep the show within a reasonable time frame, but I'm going to try. So I'm going to talk about a couple of things that I've been personally doing to share my experiences with you. One is I set up a Server One by Start9 Labs that I had purchased a couple weeks back. So that's running StartOS on episode 29, I believe. I had Matt Hill, who is the founder of Start9 Labs, on the podcast talking about their project. So I picked up one of their servers and started setting that up. and I've been having a lot of fun and it's really cool. So I'm going to talk about that, specifically around setting up a Simple X server, a Nostr relay, a Nextcloud server, Bitcoin nodes, so on and so forth. I am in the process, actually, as we are doing this right now, this show, of a transaction to purchase a new IBM ThinkPad from Amazon.com through an intermediary, which I've mentioned in the past, called Anonshop.app. And I paid for it with Monero. And they're basically a middleman service. So they will purchase marketplace items for you. They can ship them to a storage locker or any address you want. They can even receive it directly and forward it somewhere. So I'm going to talk about that so far. Then there is some things I'd like to touch on. One is about, obviously, if you've heard the news about Facebook getting popped for snooping on Snapchat traffic and a secret project, there are some documents that were revealed under a project called Project Ghostbusters. That is kind of interesting, but I'm actually going to highlight another story which just recently came out also that I'm going to talk about, which is Facebook giving Netflix access to texts and within the Facebook platform, Facebook message data and content data. I say those that word interchangeably. And Google also, you know, is in hot water over Google incognito browsing, still collecting data and that kind of thing. And there's a really cool little piece by First Spot that I'm going to discuss. So kind of cover those things. And if I can get to the rest of them, the Canadian government wanting to ban the Flipper Zero, which is hilarious. There's also a Mashable article that I want to touch on, talking about Google being ordered to hand over YouTube viewer data, which is kind of scary. So yeah, we'll talk about that. I don't know if we'll get to this, but I thought if anything, I'll just leave it in the show notes. It's the Jeffrey Epstein's island visitors exposed by a data broker, and they actually have heat maps of of the people on the island based upon their mobile device information. So I thought that was kind of hilarious and kind of interesting. Some privacy concerns around the Grindr app. There's some plans to squeeze some of its users, no pun intended there with the title. That's the article title. Also, something I found interesting is how Apple plans to update new iPhones without opening them. And they want to get rid of the iPhone update post process by being able to update the phones in the box. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Also going to be talking about a couple of cool tools. One of them, well, actually in this case, probably just this one. There's a lot of services out there to delete your information. I'm not a fan of them, but there is a Just Delete Me project, which is a directory of direct links to delete your account from specific web services. So it's basically a roadmap for DIY. If you don't want to listen to this whole episode, you can just go to justdeleteme.xyz and everything is on there. And I just thought it was a really cool thing to share. And then also, if we can get to it, why the White House is wrong about Section 702. I've mentioned Section 702, which was coming up for expiration, I think at the end of this month in April, and how there's a call for needing drastic change by the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So that's going to be the gist of it. Before we go further, I just want to give a thank you to all the listeners and supporters, to our Privacy Badass supporters on Patreon, Michael Bates, Richard G., also Turquoise Panda, Bon, Circus Media, Pixel Jones, and White Coat Black Hat. You all have been like so consistent with helping financially support the podcast. I'm going to be adding even more infrastructure, considerable amount this year, I think, which means I just kind of take those expenses on myself because I want to do them and I believe in this project and I believe in trying to create places for people to go and share ideas, share tutorials, their experiences on how to do things, setting things up, self-hosting, mobile phone setup, email aliasing, and anyways, I really appreciate all of those efforts, and those go into the project: hardware, computers, hosting fees, microphones, all that fun stuff. So for instance, you know, the website, the Mastodon server, we're going to be setting up a Discord server, and I'm also going to be hosting a SimpleX server for those that want to use it over Tor. I may or may not open that up to the ClearNet, as well as a Noster relay. For those that aren't not familiar with Noster, that is notes and other stuff on relays. I think that's what it stands for. It's built on a decentralized platform around Bitcoin, allowing people to pass value for value through their messages. There's no algorithm that dictates what you see. So it's kind of like Mastodon, which is another kind of decentralized social network that isn't sitting on top of Bitcoin or anything like that. But I'm just really looking for alternatives. Kind of getting tired of Twitter lately. There's been a lot of porn in my feed. When I say that, it's like, I'm not joking. Like, just straight up, like, I've never experienced this before. Scrolling, you click into a tweet thread and you're scrolling and reading through the comments, and before you know it, it's like OnlyFans bombed by like a dozen girls posting stuff, and it's just kind of over it. So I've been thinking about nuking my Twitter account. I don't know if I will nuke it or just stay off the platform. But I'll kind of talk about that a little bit more. But anyways, there's a lot of infrastructure and hosting that goes into this project. And I call it a project because that's really all it is. It's not a business or anything like that. It's just me and you and a bunch of people that help out. Mattis Max on Intelligent 7 are our moderators. They've been amazing. And they've been helping for a very long time with helping run those servers, as well as welcoming people to the chat and kind of kicking people when they need to, doing spam monitoring within our Mastodon server. It's just a lot of tasks that kind of need to be done to make things work well. So all of the support is super appreciated. And I really want to see, the community grow together, because I'm just really the person that kind of does that. I feel like I'm like just like trafficking things, but it's really the people in the chat room and people like Mattis Max on Intelligent 7, Michael Bates, Richard G. Bond, all you guys who are always there, being kind of like I can depend on to kind of help me out. So just a very warm, genuine thank you to all of you people. I really couldn't do it without all of those people. I really couldn't. I would have given up a long time ago. A lot of times too, just the kind words and emails and DMs from people, especially when they, you know, saying, "Hey, I really enjoyed the show. Me and a friend listened. We really liked it. Keep going, keep doing it." Because sometimes I don't necessarily feel like I have imposter syndrome or anything like that, but sometimes I feel like, am I the right person to do this? Because there are definitely more qualified people to speak on a lot of these topics that I talk about on this podcast. But hey, I'll just keep showing up and doing it, and hopefully more frequently. So thank you all. Before I get into any of these subjects, I just kind of wanted to, you just listen. It's a 4-minute clip. This is about the Facebook gives access to Netflix and their user information. It's a little, this actual post came out 5 days ago. So on April 1st, it wasn't an April Fool's joke. I wish it was, but it's not. So we're just going to go ahead and we're just going to listen to this, getting into the mood, shall we?
For our next story, let me ask you a question. What does big tech know about you? Well, the answer is, practically everything. Big tech knows everything about you. They have all your data and they're using it to cut million-dollar deals. Facebook has been accused of giving Netflix access to private messages. Google has been accused of tracking users, even in incognito mode. There have been lawsuits. There have been settlements. But big tech is unlikely to stop anytime soon. We live in a world where data means money and privacy means very little. Our next report tells you how big tech has been misusing your data and making money off you.
Imagine a day in your life. Your smartphone wakes you up. Your smartwatch tracks your fitness goals. Your cab rides are tracked. Your commute is mapped. Your coffee order is documented, and so are your food preferences. The way you live, the clothes you wear, the songs you like, and even the dreams you dream. All of that data is collected. In the 21st century, privacy is a relic of the past. Big tech knows everything about you. It collects hordes of personal data, because in today's world, data is money. And it's being used to seal billion-dollar deals. Take Netflix and Facebook, for example. In 2017, Facebook launched its own streaming service. It was called Facebook Watch. Facebook had lofty goals. They were planning original TV shows. But in 2018, all plans were shelved. Why? Because Netflix asked them to. But don't think of this as some friendly compromise. Netflix knew Facebook could emerge as a competitor, so they cut them a deal. Netflix was already a large advertiser to Facebook, but since 2018, they have ramped up spending. In 2018, Netflix spent $150 million on ads on Facebook. By 2019, it went up to $200 million. Not just that, there were other deals. If you thought your messages were private on Facebook, think again. Netflix was allegedly granted access to inboxes of Facebook users. This was in exchange of million-dollar advertising deals. So Facebook was showing your messages to Netflix and in turn earning millions. All of this has come out in a recent lawsuit. It's a class action antitrust case against Meta. But Facebook isn't the only one hoarding your data. So is Google. How many times have you browsed in incognito mode? You thought it was a great shield against tracking. But the truth is, even in a private browsing mode, Google was still collecting your data. In 2020, it faced a class action lawsuit in the US. It accused the tech giant of invading people's privacy. It sought $5 billion in damages. Google disputed the claims, but it agreed to settle the lawsuit. So Google will now destroy hundreds of billions of private browsing records. It will also have to submit to restrictions on its power to track users. So, two lawsuits, two big tech companies, and hordes of personal data. It shows how much big tech knows about us. It tracks every gesture, monitors every purchase, analyzes every comment, and influences our behavior, with one algorithm and advertisement at a time. Big tech looms large as the ultimate arbiter of our digital existence. They are truly the Orwellian overlords of the digital age. If you wonder how much big tech knows about us, the answer is practically everything. And they use this data to their advantage. In today's age where data is king, big tech has reduced us to mere pawns.
So I didn't know about that. I didn't know that there was that kind of money. So in 2019, $200 million a year, that's over $16.5 million a month in advertising fees being paid to Meta for, you know, from Netflix in exchange, getting direct access to user content, not just data, not just name, age, location, demographic, income, political leaning, none of that stuff, but actual messages, which is really, really disheartening. And that comes right after an article that there was tons of articles. This particular one is a TechCrunch article that came out on March 26th about, and I'm sure you've probably heard about it, Facebook snooping on users' Snapchat traffic in a secret project that documents revealed. And this was called Project Ghostbusters. So in 2016, Facebook launched a secret project designed to intercept and decrypt network traffic between people using Snapchat's app and its servers. The goal was to understand users' behavior and help Facebook compete with Snapchat, according to newly unsealed court documents. Facebook called this Project Ghostbusters in a clear reference to Snapchat's ghost-like logo. It says on Tuesday, a federal court in California released new documents discovered as part of the class action lawsuit between consumers and Meta, Facebook's parent company. So I won't go into the detail. There's a lot of analysis on this online. One of my favorite YouTubers, Some Ordinary Gamers, Muduhar, is always breaking stuff like this down. And I really liked his insight. But essentially, there was a company that Facebook had acquired, which was, I think, somewhere in the mid-teens, 20-teens, somewhere in there. But they had made an app to help people reduce their data that they were transmitting as far as the size, because there was a lot of still constraint over data bandwidth per month, like how much allocation you had, how much you were using. So like downloading movies or MP3s or watching videos would count against that data cap that you had with your cellular provider. You had so much bandwidth you could use. So this application would kind of compress a lot of this data down to reduce how much you were actually sending and receiving, which was helpful for users, but it essentially also gave like full, it was kind of like a full VPN sort of. And that company was acquired. They were called Anavo, O-N-A-V-O, and they were acquired by Facebook in 2013. And so they used that technology to essentially snoop on Snapchat's users. They were able to see the traffic before it was encrypted and sent to Snapchat servers for the sole purpose of identifying opportunities or weaknesses within Snapchat that they could leverage to improve their marketing, to get people to use Facebook more than Snapchat. And around that time, you had a younger generation of mobile phone users who were starting to get bigger by the day and not really caring about Facebook. So I think that was in an effort to try to get them to care. Cause like now Facebook, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of seemed this way for a while. And if you've listened to previous episodes where I've had different people on of different ages, they kind of look at Facebook as like the old person's social network platform. They usually, if they go on it at all, it's to use the Facebook marketplace, but they don't really use it to communicate with their friends. They use other platforms for that. And I think Meta/Facebook has been trying to figure out how do we get this younger crowd, because eventually their user base is going to start shrinking and they won't be able to demand massive marketing budget fees from companies like Netflix for $200 million a year and political campaigns and all that kind of stuff. So really shady business practice. It appears that Mark Zuckerberg actually wrote in an email in June of 2016, which was published part of the lawsuit, saying, given how quickly they're growing, referring to Snapchat, it seems important to figure out a new way to get reliable analytics about them. Perhaps we need to do panels or write custom software. You should figure out how to do this, talking to his internal team. And that's when those engineers decided to use that Anavo, you know, app that they had purchased to basically snoop on their users. And yeah, I mean, just real shady stuff, real shady stuff. So I'll get into some of these other articles. I kind of wanted to talk about some things that I'm working on right now that you may find beneficial, hopefully, and maybe setting up yourself or using part of ours down the road. But like I mentioned earlier, I purchased a Start9 server. I upgraded it to the 4 terabyte NVMe drive from the 2 terabyte. So it was a total of $600. You don't need to buy a server to do this. You can install it yourself on your own server. But I wanted to go ahead and support this project. I wanted to see what the experience was like. And so far, it's been great. I actually shot a video on it. I don't know if it's going to suck or not, so I don't know if I'm going to post it to the YouTube channel, but I'm planning to. It's my goal to try to make video content, tutorials, reviews that are really aimed at listeners of the podcast. I mean, if I can appeal to the general audience on YouTube and other platforms, that's great. That's not my sole purpose, though. It's to utilize video to demonstrate some of these things that I talk about, because I understand that sometimes visuals help more than just listening to someone talk. So that's kind of why I'm doing that. I haven't edited that video, but I'll be working on that over the next few days. And if I get it uploaded, it will definitely be in the next show notes, or you can just subscribe to the YouTube channel. But basically, was just setting up the server, getting it installed, which was super easy. They have their own custom Linux distribution that ships with the device. So when you hook it up, all you really do is just open a web browser. You navigate to the IP address of the server and you start the setup process. And I set up a Bitcoin node, but then I immediately was like, okay, I have other Bitcoin nodes. I know what all that stuff's about, which is cool. I want to try that out, but what other stuff can I do with this? So I set up a SimpleX server. And for those that are not familiar, SimpleX is a very robust, very cool end-to-end encrypted chat program that doesn't rely on phone numbers. You can have multiple identities and you can host your own server. Unlike some of these other end-to-end encrypted apps that we probably all have known and used, like Signal, Session, some of these other ones, where you're ultimately connecting to a centralized server or a centralized network. Yes, you can host relays, but ultimately they all kind of host, come back to central server. It's not one server, but you understand. So SimpleX is really neat because you can just download and install the app from the App Store, from wherever you want. And you can use the SimpleX servers out of the box, which is great, which will help you be connected. You can add friends and you can join group chats and different community chats and things like that. And for the record, we actually do have our own closed network podcast, SimpleX group. The link will be in the show notes per request from someone in the Matrix chat the other day. So that link will be in the show notes. It's a little long. I'm not going to find a way to hopefully simplify that. But I actually set up the server. It was a one-click installation. And then I went to the configuration tab. It generates a Tor URL, an onion URL. So it's only accessible over Tor. Well, that's cool because I already run Orbot on my Pixel. And I just select which apps I want to go through Tor. So my whole phone is not running through Tor. I just have specific applications that I want to connect over Tor. But that's really cool because anything you host at your house that has the ability to host over Tor, meaning it has an onion address, then you can access anywhere on the planet without needing to set up a VPN, without needing to use a reverse proxy or anything like that to get back into your home network. Of course, you could set up a VPN in your home network or a reverse proxy. Those things are great. I'm just saying you don't even have to do that. You just install Tor, like Orbot, on your phone, and then you can add the onion URL for the server inside the SimpleX chat settings. You can turn off all the other servers, and boom, you're on SimpleX talking to everybody using your own server, which I know in this day and age, like anyone can host just about anything. But what I was impressed was how easy it was to set it up. And I'm a fairly technical person. Like, I do a lot of hosting and configuration. I have a reverse proxy set up. I have a VPN set up. I use Tailscale. Like, I have ways to get into my network. But I just thought this was really cool because if you have none of that, you just set the server up, plug it in your router, and you copy the Tor onion URL and you put it in your SimpleX server config on your device. And now anywhere you go on the planet, you're connected to SimpleX via over Tor through your own server. I just thought it was kind of neat. I also then set up a Nostr relay. Nostr is, like I said before, kind of a decentralized social platform similar to the user experience of, like, say, Twitter or something like that. But you can connect it to a Bitcoin wallet. So if there's people or creators that you like, say podcasters, video creators, developers for projects, and you follow them and they put out, like, let's say they put out an update on a new piece of software that you like to use, you can zap them Satoshis, zap sats to them right on their message. I won't call it a tweet because it's not a tweet, but it's, they call them notes. And it's just really neat. So the way that works though is you can create an account and you kind of automatically get connected to a handful of relays. It's the relay operator's job to keep a retention of your messages. That way, every time you open up your application, your messages get loaded into your feed, things that you've sent and received and DMs and things like that. But there's no length of time that you know that those messages will maybe eventually be deleted because depending upon which relays you're using, if their message retention policy is like 6 months or a year or 3 months, you may lose some of that stuff. But the way it works, though, is that if, let's say you're using a relay, if you zap that relay Satoshis, you can kind of have this, you know, contract with them that they'll kind of retain your data for you. But if you set up your own relay and add it, your own relay will always keep a backup of your stuff. So you won't ever have to worry about it. Now, by default, this relay is set up as a private relay, meaning only you or the people that have the relay address can use it. However, you could make it public if you wanted to, and people could zap USATs for kind of like hosting that relay. And the relay might, you know, depends on how many people are using it, could kind of fill up with some disk space, but disk space is fairly cheap. So let's say they upload images or post a video, right? That would get stored on your relay, but it could also be a way for you to make Bitcoin by being a relay operator. And you could host multiple relays if you want. Really, all it is for you is a little electricity, bandwidth, and disk space and CPU power. It doesn't require that much CPU. And within StartOS, they kind of run similar to like Docker servers. I'd actually need to do a little bit more investigation because they actually have a really cool like updating system and everything within their ecosystem for their like app store, or what they call their marketplace. And there's other ones out there that I currently use today, like Casa OS, like Umbral, but I'm trying different things and I want to see what works best so I know what best to recommend. These are all open source projects. You don't have to pay any money. You can install them on your own hardware. But the beauty is that you're kind of taking back, you're actually hosting these dependencies within your own network infrastructure in your house or your office, your dorm, wherever. And it doesn't really require a lot of CPU power. These are low power systems. So if you have an old laptop, an old laptop, an old desktop computer, or one that you pick up really cheap. I've purchased two Dell Optiplexes with 32 gigabytes of RAM with Core i7 processors off of eBay. It didn't come with any hard drives, and I purchased them each for around $150 US plus shipping, and they're both working fantastically well. I basically just threw in some brand new hard drives, and I've been running different servers on them and really enjoying it. So I don't know. I'll keep you posted, but I'm really enjoying StartOS. I also really enjoy Casa OS, and I've been using Umbral for quite some time. I also, over the holiday, actually, this will be a different conversation, but I also have a Ronin Dojo server, a Tonto, that I bought from Ronin Dojo for a Black Friday sale. I had problems with it. They currently have it in. There was a problem with the hardware, and they're replacing it, and they're sending it back. It's just taking a long time to go through that process. We're in April, and I bought it back in November, and it's been a couple months now, almost 2 months now since I've had it. They have been very good at communicating with me, but it's been a bit of an ordeal. All that to say is I've said it earlier I think it was in January this year, or I can't remember which podcast episode it was, 30 maybe, where I said I really want to focus on more heavily taking back agency over my data, and not just my data. Now, when I say data, I don't just mean files, pictures, and messages. I mean metadata too. What servers I'm connecting to, what service providers I'm using, what device IDs I'm using, because it's just getting to be like, if you start implementing different tools and devices and hardware to learn on and experiment with, then 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now, you're going to be the veteran that's helping your friends and family take it to the next level, because there's probably going to be some things that we'll learn by that time that will really start making people go like, wow, I'm not really trusting Apple. I'm not trusting Google. I'm not trusting big tech. What do I do? What are my options? Where do I go? How do I function in society after being so embedded with all these tech companies? So that's what self-hosting is all about. But it's also about like helping people and, you know, kind of banding together. Like, I don't think everyone should self-host. I think it's kind of ridiculous. I don't think like I need to self-host all my own stuff. My brother needs to self-host. Like, I don't think so. You kind of come together and you say, hey, let's self-host some of these things together. Let's share the expense. Let's set up a backup server at your house. So if something happens, we can, you know our data's safe. And you start kind of working on these things in with like your friends or your family as a group. And it becomes very rewarding. And so I encourage you to do that. And if you don't know where to start, come join our chat room and we'll help you out. We'll help you out get started. I am planning to set up another SimpleX server just for the closed network, what I'm calling the Pod Squad. That sounds kind of lame, but I thought it was kind of funny, the Pod Squad. So that you can also just use ours if you want to. Like, it's kind of going to be for us. We're going to set up a Nostr relay. We're going to set up a SimpleX server. Unintelligent 7 and Mattis Max and I are kind of working on behind the scenes some other resources that will be helpful and beneficial to everyone. A Discord server is what I think we're going to do, which is similar to like a forum, but it's a place where we can put tutorials and guides, resources, links, kind of have everything in one place. Because right now I talk about things in each episode. The links are in the show notes, so they're kind of there, but I don't have all of that information centralized or tagged or categorized very well. So this is the year that we're going to kind of try to do better at organizing a lot of this information so that it's indexed and easy to find. And we can link people right to it when they join the chat. We have like 227 people in there, which is blows my mind because it's a bit of like effort to download an app and sign up an account and go to the website and join the chat. So it's like not, I mean, it's easy, but it's kind of like you have to want to do it. So it's really neat to see that number grow and very humbling at the same time. That, you know, so many people find this interesting enough to join the community on the chat, because I think I'm, you know, mediocre at best at doing this, maybe slightly better than mediocre some days, but pretty average overall. So it kind of, that's why I say it humbles me. So into the next part of what I'm experimenting with, I've talked about in the past, and I'm hoping maybe to get them on the show. No promises, but I'm reaching out to a few different teams and projects to see if they want to. I have some questions for them, and one of them is anonshop.app. It's A-N-O-N shop.app. They are a service where you can purchase something from Amazon. I think they'll even let you purchase from other places. And they will purchase it on your behalf. They do charge a fee for this service. They've got to make money. And you can pay them in Monero. So they don't even have to know your... There's no name. So I'll just kind of give you a quick... the way the process works. You go to the website and you say you want to place a purchase. You don't give them your email address. You don't give them your name. Basically, it creates an order. And so you put in the URL of the product that you'd like, how much it costs, what you want as far as like it forwarded somewhere, or if it's in the case of Amazon, if it's an Amazon direct purchase, it can go to a storage locker. So you can select, give the storage locker information, and then you go to it. You can also give a tip, and then it goes to a checkout page. When it creates that order, it creates like a seed phrase. If you have ever used a Bitcoin wallet or something, there's a mnemonic phrase, usually 12 words or 24 words or some variation of that. They create an 8-word mnemonic phrase. So you need to write that down or store it in your password manager or put it somewhere safe so that you can bring it back up again, because that's how you're going to access your order for status, for communication, for tracking, all of it. So if you lose it, you're kind of FUBAR and just hope the product shows up. But I think that's like awesome, because there's no URL that's emailed to you. There's nothing even emailed. You can just log into a VPN, go to their website, buy a product, have it shipped to a storage locker, and you paid for it with Monero. And then you can go to the storage locker of your location, wear a hat, wear some sunglasses, wear a COVID mask if you want, if they have surveillance cameras, pick up your product and leave. And there's no trace to you that you purchased it. So I did it with a laptop because I've been wanting a new ThinkPad. I'm toying around. We're kind of talking about it in the Matrix chat. I want to run Cubes OS. I probably won't stick with it. I'll probably just eventually just throw Arch Linux on there. But I want to give it a shot. So I got one with 64 gigabytes of RAM, 2 terabyte drive, and a high resolution screen, which is what I care about. I can't work on a 1080 screen. I'm sorry. It's just I can't do it. So most of the ThinkPads out there have all 1080p resolution, and it just drives me nuts. So this was kind of a specific laptop, and I've mentioned in the chat, talked about with people, I love System 76. I have a System 76 Oryx Pro. It's too big. It's too clunky. It's great, though. I love it. And I looked at framework, but I just want a 14-inch thin, light laptop. I want a higher than 1080p resolution. Okay-ish speakers I'm okay with. Most of the time I'm wearing headphones. And a Core i7 is fine. Even an i5 is fine. And it's hard to find a laptop with those specs. A 14-inch, thin, lightweight, because I carry two laptops with me. I carry a MacBook Pro, and I carry the personal laptop. In this case, it's a ThinkPad. And I really want to do like a Lemur Pro or something from System 76, but it just falls short on the specs. Maybe the next one. I think they're getting better. I'm just kind of stuck in my ways, and I want what I want. And so that's what I'm going to do. Even though I'm not a fan of Lenovo. But anyways, I will let you know. I'll keep you everyone updated on how this is going, because right now it's supposed to arrive sometime in the next week or two, I think. So I'll keep you apprised of it. But so far, I will say the communication has been very prompt, very responsive. The experience has been good, hopefully, because they've got my Monero. So hopefully this goes well. So I'll keep you posted on that whole experiment, that whole process. So something else that was interesting. Last month marks the 10-year anniversary from when Obama issued his, I don't know what you call it. I'm actually pulling up the articles. I have it in my tab here. He issued his kind of stay on NSA bulk spying, kind of like a call to end the NSA's bulk data collection. That was in March of 2014. And once a year, I try to do it usually in the spring or summertime. Usually it's around June. I usually watch Citizen 4 or I watch Snowden, the movie. And it's just something I like to do because this, if you remember Snowden, the Snowden leaks, the documents came out in June of 2013. And in January, you know, he was basically being targeted, and the White House administration was scrambling, the Department of Homeland Security scrambling, DOD was scrambling to try to shed some like positivity over the unveiling of all this NSA surveillance, all these NSA surveillance programs. And in March, Obama called to end the NSA's bulk data collection. And I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs. This is from a New York Times article on March 24th, 2014. That the Obama administration is preparing to unveil a legislative proposal for a far-reaching overhaul of the National Security Agency's once secret bulk phone records program in a way that, if approved by Congress, would end the aspect that has most alarmed privacy advocates since its existence was leaked last year, according to the senior administration officials. Under the proposal, they said the NSA would end its systematic collection of data about Americans' calling habits. The bulk records would stay in the hands of phone companies, which would not be required to retain the data for any longer than they normally would. And the NSA could obtain specific records only with permission from a judge using a new kind of court order. Well, and we know from what was it? Episode 30. Yeah, I think it was 30 where I was talking about no reasonable expectation of privacy due to the third party doctrine, which of course the, you know, third party data of phone companies is your records. So don't expect to have any reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to telco providers, including your cellular providers. Assume, number one, that your data will be breached and leaked on the internet multiple times. I'm looking at you, T-Mobile. And now AT&T with 76 million records leaked. They denied it, then finally said, yeah, it happened. Change your passwords. So they're all going to get breached. But on top of that, they're collecting this stuff, not just for themselves, for the government, but for their own marketing purposes and to sell that data to data brokers. You know, locations and frequency, and, you know, all that fun stuff. So fast forward to, and there's also a link on the Guardian about the same thing. Obama formally proposes end to NSA's bulk collection of telephone data. And I'll have these links in the description, or in the description, in the show notes. However, you know, when he left office, and don't get me wrong, I'm not like just knocking on Obama here. It's just, you know, this actually falls under a lot of presidents, the Bushes big time, George W. Bush, who really pushed for the Patriot Act and the expansion of the National Defense Authorization Act here in the United States, which basically allowed unwarrantless spying and surveillance on everyone and everything, not just Americans, but I mean, not just foreign national, everybody, just spy on everybody. But when he left office in January 2017, he rolled back a lot of that. And that was probably expected. I mean, you got to do some damage control when something as big as Snowden leaks come out in June of 2013. So, you know, and here he is in January of 2017. Actually, I have a little bit of a clip from his address in January of 2017 that I found kind of, you know, but he's playing the game. He's got to do what you got to do.
The horror of September 11th brought all these issues to the fore. Across the political spectrum, Americans recognized that we had to adapt to a world in which a bomb could be built in a basement and our electric grid could be shut down by operators an ocean away. We were shaken by the signs we had missed leading up to the attacks. How the hijackers had made phone calls to known extremists and traveled to suspicious places. So we demanded that our intelligence community improve its capabilities and that law enforcement change practices to focus more on preventing attacks before they happen than prosecuting terrorists after an attack. It is hard to overstate the transformation America's intelligence community had to go through after 9/11. Our agencies suddenly needed to do far more than the traditional mission of monitoring hostile powers and gathering information for policymakers. Instead, they were now asked to identify and target plotters in some of the most remote parts of the world and to anticipate the actions of networks that by their very nature cannot be easily penetrated with spies or informants. And it is a testimony to the hard work and dedication of the men and women of our intelligence community that over the past decade, we've made enormous strides in fulfilling this mission.
Enormous strides in fulfilling this mission. I mean, we all know that, you know, there was the X-Keyscore program. There was all these different surveillance programs, indexing, real-time, you know, phone calls, text messages, emails. Those were the primary ways, forms of communication. There wasn't a whole lot of end-to-end encrypted. Heck, most things weren't even fully HTTPS then. And so it was just this dragnet surveillance program with all these different programs that the NSA had developed in-house in conjunction with the military industrial complex to basically surveil everybody. Now, you know, Bush was just the one in office when this all kind of, or sorry, Bush, Obama was just the one in office when all of this, you know, came to a head. So he's trying to do damage control. That really, I look at the, you know, George H.W. Bush, W. Bush, you know, the rollout of Patriot Act, all these different things. It's kind of like, and that's not just where it started, but that's where it expanded into digital surveillance, not just, you know, the traditional means of surveilling and doing mass surveillance. But all that to say is, you know, that was 10 years ago. This, that speech that where you're just playing that clip was in January of 2014. And so I'm always thinking about like, well, what has happened since then? since then, when we know that the bulk surveillance, you know, is probably there's data centers being built all over the place. There's exchange of information with foreign governments from the United States and sharing this bulk data. And I just assume everything is always being monitored. And that's what drives me to say, well, fine, okay. Then what can I do to, you know, ensure that I'm not being scooped in an unwarranted dragnet surveillance program, not just, you know, from the government, but also for marketing purposes, for data broker. You know, you heard the clip at the beginning I played that news anchor talking about, the news journalist talking about basically everything you do from the moment you wake up, your alarm going off on your iPhone, or your Apple Watch, or whatever, your Pixel Watch, or whatever it is. And I'm talking about the normies here. A lot of people that listen to this podcast don't use this stuff. But for the everyday person, from your alarm clock to your pattern, getting up, what purchases, what you're listening to when you get in the shower on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever it is, whatever streaming service, it's all these data streams are being captured, looked at, and used in a formula to target you to give your attention to something else that you weren't originally intending to throughout the process of your routine. Your driving habits, pulling up your navigation, Google Maps, you know, so it can help you route, you know, and all these things are convenient. Don't get me wrong. Like I do appreciate convenience, but I'm starting to, you know, have now been untraining myself and accepting that, you know, it's okay for things to have a little friction sometimes. If the trade-off is that no one's snooping into my personal life, what time I got up, what time I go to the bathroom, what I read when I'm, you know, sitting down on the toilet, right? Or before I get in the shower, when I'm playing, all these different things, because it shouldn't be anyone's business what I'm doing. Who you're talking to, what social media apps you're scrolling on, what time you take your lunch break and where you like to go and all those things. I mean, if you think about, you know, just kind of like mental exercise as you go through the day, think about like how you use your phone, what your phone's doing in the background, what services you're using, what IoT devices are in your home that are listening to you and trying to fill this, you know, gap of convenience and that kind of thing for you, but also the trade-off in that, whether it's a Nest camera or an Echo or whatever. And just start looking at it through the lens of what you're giving up every time you have those interactions and how that could be used against you later on down the road and how you'd like to unplug from that. And it's really important to not be overwhelmed by these concepts and say, oh my gosh, that's insane. Like, I didn't really think about it that way. I got to throw all my stuff in the lake tomorrow. It's like, well, eventually, yes, you'll get there, but it's baby steps. You didn't get to where you are overnight. It's over the last decade and a half that you probably got to the point where you're at. You're not just going to untether all of that overnight. It's going to take some time, and you want to do it in a way that you don't screw yourself and lose data, lose photos and that kind of thing, lose your contacts, right? Stuff like that. You start slow, and each and every week and month that goes by, you're incorporating new things into your life. The very first thing that you could do, the simplest thing you could do, is secure your accounts, right? Use a password manager. I recommend KeePass XC. That's a local password manager you can just install on your phone. You're going to want to keep a copy of that database somewhere. If you're not comfortable with that, I would use Bitwarden and pay them. It's like $30 a year. What we'll do is we'll keep track of all your usernames and your passwords. You want to have a unique password for every single online account that you have. Because if you don't, especially in the scenario like recently, when the last 2 weeks where it's been exposed that AT&T has had a massive data leak, the first thing they do is tell their customers, go change your password. Well, a lot of people will use the same password or the same four or five passwords they rotate for like everything. So if one account is breached and leaked and thrown on a hacker forum, the script kiddies go to work. These are hackers who basically run these passwords and user accounts through scripts that say, try to log into all these accounts, all these social media accounts, bank accounts, anything, using this email address and this password. And if that one doesn't work, use one of these other three that this person had, because they even keep track of those. But if you have one unique password for that login, they may be able to get into that account, but they're not going to be able to brute force their way into all your other accounts. And then on top of that, use a multi-factor authentication application. A hardware key like a YubiKey would be even better, but at least just start with something. You can download Aegis. That's AEGIS. It's an open source password or authenticator app where it generates a code for you. So anywhere of your accounts where you can use multi-factor authentication, use it. When you get to the next level, you're going to buy yourself some hardware keys. And that will be a hardware device that you have to have on you to get into these accounts. And then next will be, you know, use a privacy respecting email account. Use a privacy respecting like email alias service. Simple login is a great example. So that way now you have a different unique email address and a unique password for every single online account you have. And all those email aliases can go to one or two or three different main inboxes. You don't have to be logged into 1,000 emails. They just forward to your regular email, but no one knows the original email, or your actual email. It's just some simple techniques that you can start out with. If you're in the United States, you have the luxury of using something like privacy.com, where you can create virtual debit cards. So it does connect to your bank account. And you'll log in with your bank account. You'll connect it like a debit card. But then you can create a virtual card. So if you do want to sign up for Netflix, sign up with an email alias. Sign up with a one-time password. You've set those up in Bitwarden. So they can't even correlate it to anything else, any other data that they have on you or they're going to sell about you. And then have the billing go to a privacy.com credit card using a fake name. You make up a name. I'm going to talk about SOC accounts in another episode and creating basically fake profiles. They don't even have to be of you, just so that you can use the internet as a different persona. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. I'm not talking about catfishing people. I'm talking about if you want to sign up for the New York Times, if you want to sign up for Reddit or anything, or even Facebook, or if you want to use Instagram because you love Instagram and you're a photographer, fine. Use a fake persona. Use an email alias, then we get into other things like, pseudo phone numbers, using things like SilentLink for eSIMs and pay for it with Bitcoin. Like it kind of starts to snowball. You're not going to get there overnight. Eventually you're going to become a super freak, right? I'm a super freak. A lot of people that listen to this are super freaks. And what I mean by that, I mean that in like a good way, like in a, like a Little Miss Sunshine way, right? You ever seen Little Miss Sunshine? I love that movie. It's a family of super freaks. They're just a bunch of freaks, but in the end, they come together and they embrace that together. And it's what bonds them together is their weirdness and how screwed up they are. And if you haven't seen that movie, it's hilarious. It's a great one of my favorite films. Give it a watch, Little Miss Sunshine. So you become a super freak about how you move about in the digital world and what information you give to people. A lot of, just the other day, we're in the car, my son and I were coming back and we were talking about identifiable stickers on cars, like you see the family that has like the Star Wars members on the back. And so you can tell there's like two boys and a girl and a baby and a dog and whatever. And it's like, I know those things are cute, but they give away a lot of information about yourself. How many people are in your family that you own pets? Now I have your tag number. I know what kind of car you drive. I'm just saying, start looking at things like through the matrix, like in a meta kind of way, where you, if you actually just start training yourself to do that, you go to anywhere you go, coffee house, coffee shop, grocery store, probably not the grocery store so much, but places where people are kind of like chilling and have their guard down, they will give a lot of information out. They'll have open conversations talking to a friend or family member, and they're just saying all sorts of personal information about themselves, where they went, what trip they went on, the so-and-so from school, and, oh, I just met up with them, and, yeah, it's been 10, yeah, we saw them at the 10-year reunion, you know, that kind of thing. You can glean a lot of information about people just by being perceptive, visually and, you know, audibly, like your surroundings. So imagine applications and networks like social media networks that take that and just we're giving them all this information, like Facebook. I mean, literally everyone's using their real name, where they went to school. LinkedIn is probably one of the worst. LinkedIn is one of the best resources for hackers. When they're trying to break into a company or they're going to social engineer their way into somewhere, they can easily find out what targets to hit based upon the company profiles and the roles of the employees within that company. If I want to hack a company, I'm just going to go start looking up database administrators and systems engineers. I might start with the customer service rep to just learn some operational security stuff they might have. If I wanted to hack your bank account or something like that, I might start to who works at that bank? Who can I talk to? Who can I network with? Who can I, you know, start doing reconnaissance. That's all called open source investigation, OSINT, right? Privacy, that's Michael Bazell's big thing. And what I'm saying is you kind of like put this OSINT hat on and you start looking at ways to obfuscate your own identity from being a target from those threats. It happens all the time. The scam calls are happening. There's all these Apple ID password reset scams that are going on right now, and they look official because they're legit. They're even spoofing the phone number, making it look like they're calling from Apple HQ. I mean, people are going to great lengths to get to your information. I mean, if you get your iPhone hacked, like if you get your iCloud account hacked, you're done, you're toast, because they can reset your devices. Then they have access to your Apple wallet. They can have access to your bank account, any apps you have connected to it. It can be bad. All your contacts, your photos, everything. If they can get into your iCloud account, bad, bad news. Centralization is not good in every case. In some cases, it's not bad, right? Like I understand, but there's a lot of things that you want to break off from big tech and big corporations because they're the ones being targeted. And when they get hurt, you get hurt. So anyway, I kind of tangented off there. Didn't really mean to. This wasn't exactly the focus of where the podcast was, just where my mind happened to go. So we talked about Facebook. I'm not going to really go into that too much more now. I'll have the links in here if you want to go read, because it's kind of dystopian, really, when you go read these articles about what these guys are doing. And, you know, Apple's being sued for anti-competitive behavior and things. But then you also have people like Zuck, who are literally spying on competitors. Will anyone go to jail? Doubt it. Highly doubt it. But let's move back to Google. If you watched, this article came out on March 23rd on Mashable. If you watched certain YouTube videos, investigators demanded your data from Google. It's like, if you've ever jokingly wondered if your search or viewing history is going to, air quotes, put you on some kind of a list, which we all joke about, your concern may be more than warranted, they say. And now, unsealed court documents reviewed by Forbes, Google was ordered to hand over the names, addresses, telephone numbers, and user activity of YouTube accounts and IP addresses that watched select YouTube videos, part of a larger criminal investigation by federal investigators. I think about this. One of my favorite YouTube channels is called Doing Fed Time, and it's this guy who, I always say one of my favorites. These are just channels, when I see their videos, I watch them. This is a guy who went to jail because he was a darknet market vendor operator. He was a vendor. He didn't operate the website, but he was a vendor. He sold drugs on this particular website, and he went to prison. And since then, he's out. He's got an interesting YouTube channel called Doing Fed Time. So when I read this, I thought, I mean, he doesn't actually tell you, like, yeah, he actually does. He tells you, like, how you would do it today? How do you do it better? And how people get caught and what to look out for. He's not telling you to go sell drugs on darknet markets, but he's telling you like what their process was for how they would ship stuff and so that it could get through the parcel services. How could it deliver, you know, to their mail, make it successfully? It's very entertaining. I watch it because I find it entertaining. I have no desire to become an online drug lord, right? I'm trying to make it as a privacy podcaster here. That's a total joke. No, but for real, I am. So I'm not, I don't have any plans, but like, could I have been on that list if I had, I mean, I do pretty good, like to obfuscate my search history and watch history. I'm not logged in, right? But like using NewPipe and stuff, but it's still like, what if I was logged into my Google account and I went and watched that video? I'm not saying that was the video, but that could be considered, you know, criminal behavior or criminal interest. It says these videos were sent by undercover police to a suspected cryptocurrency launderer under the username Elon Musk Win. In conversations with the Bitcoin trader, investigators sent links to public YouTube tutorials on mapping via drones and augmented reality software, Forbes detailed. These videos were watched more than 30,000 times, presumably by thousands of users unrelated to the case. YouTube's parent company, Google, was ordered by federal investigators to quietly hand over all such viewer data for the period of January 1 to January 8th, 2023. But Forbes couldn't confirm if Google had complied, which who knows? Hopefully they didn't. Hopefully they didn't. They should have said, hey, if you're doing an investigation and you got a warrant with some information, like you got some IP addresses or something, let us know. We'll try to help you out. But, you know, I presume that Google may have maybe handed it over. I don't know. It's hard to say. But the request was made for these 30,000 viewers who watch this YouTube video. And let's be real. Cryptocurrency laundering? It sounds kind of interesting. I might watch that. Does it mean that I'm trying to launder money via crypto? Absolutely not. I'm a researcher. I'm a curious mind. I find all sorts of different topics fascinating. I like to watch videos on how to make the best soil for my garden and combinations of planter's mix and peat moss and all that fun stuff. I'm all over the map, right? I like mountain biking. I'm into overlanding and camping and hiking and backpacking. And yes, I like to watch videos about darknet stuff. I like the Darknet Diaries by Jack Rechider, one of my favorite podcasts on the planet. The stories are amazing. Because I find these topics fascinating. Documentaries on hackers and Bitcoiners and crypto scams, all that stuff I find interesting. So I could have easily been one of the people that watched this cryptocurrency laundering channel, a Bitcoin trader. Sure. I mean, I'm not an active trader. I've done trading in my days and mining in my days. I still do a little mining. I've got, you know, an Antminer running. I'm down to one right now. But in the heyday, you know, I had 52 GPUs mining everywhere from Ethereum to Monero to all sorts of shit coins that I would flip. So, you know, it's a topic of interest for me. I like it. So, you know, on the last podcast, I talked about, I feel attacked, like being turned into a criminal for being curious. And I kind of like, even more so, it's like, would I be considered a criminal by these people if I was one of the 30,000 viewers? I don't know. I hope not. So anyway, I'll have the article there because we don't know the outcome. And there's only three more paragraphs. Actually, I just say the mandated data retrieval is worrisome in itself, according to privacy experts. Federal investigators argued the request was legally justified as the data would be relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation, including by providing identification information about the perpetrators, citing justification used by other police forces around the country. In case of New Hampshire, police requested, or it says, in a case out of New Hampshire, police requested similar data during the investigation of bomb threats that were being streamed live to YouTube. The order specifically requested viewership information at a select timestamps during the live streams. What the F, man? I'm sorry. Like, I'm going to be curious. If I see a live stream, first of all, I'm going to think it's a troll. First, automatically, I'm going to think, oh, check out what's going on with this troll channel. If I see something about a bomb attack being live streamed, like, I'm going to click it. I mean, that's why sites like LiveLeak and WorldStar and all that stuff are so popular, or have been, right? RIP, because people like watching crazy stuff. I mean, that's what they like. That's why there's so many action movies, and that's why the news only talks about the bad things, because that's what people want to see. It says, with all law enforcement demands, we have a rigorous process designed to protect the privacy and constitutional rights of our users while supporting the important work of law enforcement. Right. Google spokesperson Matt Bryant told Forbes, we examine each demand for legal validity consistent with developing case law, and we routinely push back against overbroad or otherwise inappropriate demands for user data, including objecting to some demands entirely. Yeah, that's PR speak for damage control for, yeah, we kind of gave them the data most likely. As he says, privacy experts, however, are worried about the kind of precedent the court's order creates, citing concerns over the protections of the First and Fourth Amendments. This is the latest chapter in disturbing trends where we see government agencies increasingly transforming search warrants into digital dragnets. Executive Director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, Albert Fox Kahn, told the publication, it's unconstitutional, it's terrifying, and it's happening every day. Well, damn. I mean, you know... So what do we learn from this? You're like, hey, maybe don't be logged into your Google account looking at YouTube videos without a VPN. Maybe use YouTube, like YEWTube, or use NewPipe or RevanceD over Tor. You know, it's like, again, you have to start thinking like a criminal just to avoid accidental dragnet surveillance because you have a curious mind. That's literally what this is coming to. Just really pisses me off. So I have an article about the Canadian government proposing a ban of the Flipper Zero, and I have a Flipper Zero sitting on my desk right now. I love the Flipper Zero because it claims the device is being used to steal cars. Stop the absurd ban of Flipper Zero in Canada. There's a link to change.org. They'll probably ban it. Even though you can technically do that. It's very low power device. You actually have to really modify it. And most people who are stealing cars with RFID scanners aren't doing it with a Flipper Zero. You have to be really close to scan those key fobs. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. It's just there's better equipment. Like use the right tool for the job. If you're going to go out and actually steal cars, you need to be efficient and fast. Flipper Zero ain't going to cut it. Yes, you can technically under the right circumstances. And if you can get close enough to the fob, it could happen. But it's ridiculous because it's a toy. I mean, it's a piece of tech and it's open source. You can make one yourself. You could build one. There's better tools that you could build to steal cars, to scan those fob devices. So I won't read the article. I just kind of found it entertaining because it's so ridiculous. I wanted to touch on this. I just found it. Well, there's two things I'm going to talk about. I just want to go through this Jeffrey Epstein thing real quick, where there's an article on Wired saying how the Epstein Islands visitors were exposed by a data broker. And I found this kind of like scary and hilarious at the same time. It says devices of people who visited Jeffrey Epstein's notorious pedophile island in the years prior to his death left an invisible trail of data pointing back to their own homes and offices. Maps of these visitations generated by a troubled international data broker with defense industry ties discovered last week by Wired document the numerous trips of wealthy and influential individuals seemingly undeterred by Epstein's status as a convicted sex offender. It says the data amassed by a company called Near Intelligence, a location data broker roiled by allegations of mismanagement and fraud, reveals with high precision the residences of many guests of Little St. James, United States Virgin Islands property, where Epstein is accused of having groomed, assaulted, and trafficked countless women and girls. Some girls, prosecutors say, were as young as 14. We know this from all the articles, right? Former Attorney General of the U.S. Virgin Islands alleged that girls as young as 12 were trafficked to Epstein by those within his elite social circle. Absolutely disgusting. So they have a map. They have a map here with all the red dots. This source is actually from Near Intelligence, and then it's a Google imagery is below it with the pinpoints on there. So I just found it kind of interesting. And yeah, it's also interesting that still no one's really been charged and convicted other than Ghislaine Maxwell, which is ironically a female. I'm not saying she's not guilty of things, but of all this sex trafficking, the only person that actually goes to prison is a female. So take that with however you want. I'll have a link to that if you want to go check that article out. And Apple's planning to do updates to their new iPhones without opening them. And this is an interesting, like, kind of, this is an Ars Technica article. But the reason I brought this in to the mix was because I don't know how I feel about that. Like, that's kind of scary. So basically, Apple wants to keep their phones updated to the latest iOS version so that when their customers buy the phone and they take it home and they open it out of the box, anyone who's done that, right? You've bought even a Google Pixel before you update to Graphene OS. You got to run all security updates. It could take you freaking hours sometimes. It's not that it takes that long to download, but to apply all the updates and then reboot and all this stuff, it's a pain in the butt. So Apple's trying to roll out a way where they can update the firmware without taking the phone out of the box at all. It's still sealed. So you have one problem, whereas it doesn't have the ability to breathe. There's no ventilation, so you have a heat issue potentially. So there's a company that's come up with this device that looks like a big rack with caddies on it where they can cool the devices and update the iOS firmware wirelessly. They turn the phone on, update the software, and then power the phone off. Freaky. So it says, unboxing a new gadget is always a fun experience, but it's usually married somewhat by a setup process. Either your device has been in a box for months or it's just now launching and ships in a box with pre-release software. Either way, the first thing you do is connect to Wi-Fi, wait for several minutes for an OS update, download and install. The issue is so common that going through a lengthy download is an expected part of buying anything that connects to the internet. But what if you could update the device while it's still in the box? Well, that's the latest plan cooked up by Apple, which is close to rolling out a system that will let Apple stores wirelessly update new iPhones while they're still in their boxes. The new system is called Presto. So the French site iGeneration has the first picture of what the setup looks like. It starts with a clearly Apple-designed silver rack that holds iPhones and has a few lights on the front. The site, through translation, calls the device a toaster. And yes, it looks like a toaster. It looks like a heating rack. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, who's always big in the Apple leaks, pushing out leaks of Apple products before they come out, has been writing whispers of this project for months, saying in one article that the device can wirelessly turn on the phone, update its software, and then power it back down, all without the phone's packaging ever being opened. In another article, he wrote that the device uses MagSafe and other wireless technologies. The iGeneration report also mentions that the device uses NFC, and there are templates that will kind of help with the positioning of like the various size iPhones, so they can put them on the pad and the NFC wireless charging will just kind of connect. It says, with the wireless charging, downloading and installing, all while being isolated in a cardboard box, Apple's toaster probably gets pretty hot. No one's explained exactly how the system works, but we can make some educated guesses. Even when a phone is off or discharged, it's still possible for the NFC chip to work. Apple Pay and digital card keys are already set up to work with a low battery. Placing a box in a Presto oven would presumably trigger the NFC chip, wake the OS, and cause the phone to boot into an Apple-only unattended update mode. Hopefully there is a lot of security around this, it says in parentheses. That was freaking it. Like, I was like waiting for some other, like, hey, is there information in this article about like how they're keeping people from buying these things or using them on people's devices to, I don't know, load a different version of iOS with an exploit or something? Like, I don't know about you, but I feel great about using a Pixel, knowing like you literally have to reformat this phone or flash it to get into it. If you want to get into it, you're not updating anything on this phone without unlocking it and running it an update. I don't like the idea of there being these toaster oven racks that you can just put iPhones on and they can just update I mean, obviously these are going to appear to be controlled and everything else, but how is that going to, I mean, well, how is that going to be exploited in the wild down the road? I don't know. I would say that that's not a win. I would rather have the pain in the ass of like taking a phone home and connecting it and doing updates than know that the phone could be updated with like an entirely different OS or upgraded OS without even opening the box ever, with the phone being off. The phone's off in the box, and it can turn on, install new updates, and then turn off, and no one's the wiser. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it makes sense for Apple, but it just, I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. All right, so I have a couple of things. I'm just going to talk about the last one, and then I'm going to kill the show. There's another article in here about the White House and Section 702. I will talk about Section 702, but I'm going to wait and see how this plays out this month, because it might be like an entire episode of its own. So we're going to table that one. But I just want to talk about this service called Just Delete Me. It's not a service. It's actually just a website. I'm going to have the link in the description if you're listening, and you can just open up your browser and just type in justdeleteme.xyz. Yes, just verifying the URL, justdeleteme.xyz. And it is a directory of direct links to delete your account info from different web services. And I mean hundreds. So like there's like just on the first page, I know there are services here that I've had accounts with. 500 Pixels, yep. 99 Designs, yep. 1Password, excuse me, yep. In the past, I was once upon a time a 1Password user. Acorns, I mean, it's all alphabetical order. And if you scroll through here, you're going to see like, oh, I have an account there, I have an account there, I have an account there. And you might have deleted your accounts, but like AMD Rewards, Amazon, AWS, Amazon Audible, Ancestry, Angie's List. I mean, it's a ton of services. APK Pure. It's a massive list, but it's cool because it has a link for that service, and you click on it, and it takes you right to where you need to go to request the deletion of your account. So it's, don't get me wrong, this is a manual way of doing it, right? It's a very manual way to go through. I mean, this is something that you do over the course of months. You go through and you write down all the ones that you know you have service for, the ones that you want to delete for sure, have them delete your data. You know, SurveyMonkey's on here. I've used SurveyMonkey in the past, right? And you click the link, and it takes you right to their site, and where you can go to say delete my account, delete all my information. So, there are services out there that you can pay money monthly for, as like a subscription, that will kind of automate this process for you. I've never used them. There are some people in the privacy space that recommend them. I'm not going to recommend or not recommend them. I'm not a fan of giving all my personal information to yet another website. That's just, how the hell am I going to know what they're going to, what if they get bought by another company a year from now, and then that data gets sold? And I just don't trust these companies at all. I'd rather do it myself, even if it's a pain in the ass and it takes longer, right? What you can do today is freeze your credit reports for the United States, right? You have TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax credit reporting agencies. Is freeze your credit so no one can open up credit in your name without unfreezing your credit. And then second is to go and start the process of requesting data removal from data brokers. The second thing you can do, maybe second or third, is, so this would be the third, is poison the well. Create online fake personas that have variations of your name, variations of your birthday, but not your actual data. Like, do that. That way, when people actually do go to these like people lookup websites, they find different versions of you, and it may not be the right one. So that's another avenue you can go. because the more profiles there are of you with incorrect information, the harder it is to know which one is the right information. So if you have someone out there who's like trying to stalk you, or an ex that likes to look up your new address and stuff like that, you can kind of do things to poison the well, so to speak. That may be, I'm not going to tell you to do anything like illegal, but everyone's their own person. You're your own adult, and you figure out what you want to do, where your line in the sand is. But the simple things you could do are, you know, use cellular service that's not in your name. You can set up fake name with Mint Mobile. You can prepay it. You can buy. Heck, I was at Target this afternoon. You can pay for in cash for $45 a monthly plan for Mint Mobile, like, and activate it. Like, you can, and you can, you don't have, you know, I'm just saying, there's ways where you can actually start doing these things without using your real information. Sometimes it's unavoidable, sure. But where it is avoidable, do it. Absolutely do it. All the rewards, membership programs, and all that other crap, fake. All day fake. Fake names, fake numbers, fake email addresses, everything. Or just use burner stuff, right? So that's it. That's what I've got. That's what I got for this week. I'm cooking up some stuff for episode 33. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, if you want to join the pod squad, come over and hit us up on Matrix. It's probably the best way. We're also on Mastodon. Right now, I shut down registrations because we had a bout of spam bots joining our Mastodon server and spamming people. So we shut it down for the moment. I'm not really sure to do Mastodon server yet. Meaning, like, do we even keep it? Do we move? Do we self-host it? Do we migrate to something else? I don't know how many people are really active on Mastodon, on our instance at least. Maybe that's something you can reach out to me. So email me, simon@closednetwork.io, and let me know if you're, you know, what your thoughts are about that. If you're in the tech space, like if you're a systems engineer, you're good with Linux especially, and you have some free time to maybe help and join forces with me and Mattis Max and Unintelligent 7, then hit me up. Hit me up on Mastodon. Hit me up in the Matrix chat. Just shoot me an email and let me know. And, you know, because there's things that we're kind of working on that we could always use more help on, just infrastructure-wise and moving things around and trying to figure out the best thing. Like, should we self-host this? Should we host it on-premises? Should we do a VPS? So, also, if there's any artists out there, I've had the desire. So just kind of before the show ends, something I'm working on. I'm probably going to redo the website. That's another project that I hope to have rolled out by the summertime. But we already have an e-commerce store. So I'm going to connect it back to my BTC Pay server so we can sell stuff. Because I think it'd be fun to, if you want to support, but you also kind of want something. We have Patreon, of course. You can just go to closednetwork.io, click support. We have the Patreon, and I appreciate the support. But I'm also kind of thinking about maybe like making swag and t-shirts and mugs and other cool stuff, but like not lame ass stuff. That's like these like actually make them. Like, so my wife's big into like crafts and stuff. She makes mugs and tumblers and candles and all that. And I was like, what about t-shirts? And she's like, yeah, we can make t-shirts. I'm like, I've got some awesome ideas for like privacy trolling, like for t-shirts and stuff that we're going to maybe experiment with. I'm big into quality threads, so I have to do some research on like actually buying some quality material t-shirts. I don't want to just buy some lame ass box tees. I hate those things. So I want them to be good. But if there's interest in that, like, let me know, because I'd also be maybe looking for some help with some artwork on some of my ideas. So if that's something that you feel like you could do or be interested in, hit me up. If not, you're going to see my attempts at doing some fun artwork, which will probably just be my own versions of memes. So anyway, yeah, I don't know. This is some stuff coming down the pike, and I hopefully most of it comes to fruition and I can actually, you know, execute on a lot of this stuff, but it's going to take some help. So if you're down to help, then let me know. So until next time, episode 32, be a super freak. Come say hello. I hope things are going well in your life, and I'll catch you in the next one. To watch.
setting the stage. You should give me my props. You ain't got a soul, you lacking the spirit. You talk out your neck, I'ma show you I'm with it. I've been really happy you to sit and watch me win again and win again and win again. I know it's probably getting old, me and when I'm sending them. So if I ever win again, it's nobody that.